no good, I'll have to come back.
If you will let me.
Yeah.
Yeah. The clash of civilizations. Anyone ever heard that phrase before? Yeah? You see that mosque, that's pretty impressive there. Where do you think that is? Dearborn, Michigan. If you've got a Ford, it was made just down the road from there. That's where I ministered to Muslims in Michigan. So we're going to talk about in this next hour, Muslims in non-Muslim lands, Christians in Muslim lands, the interaction and the clash that's been taking place in modern time that we see, especially since September 11th. And then our last section will be on sharing Christ with Muslims. So here is a video about what it's like for Christians to live in a Muslim nation.
What happens to Christians who are living in these Muslim countries during Ramadan? For instance, what would happen if a Christian were seen eating between sunrise and sundown in public during this time?
Well, it depends on the location. If it's, say, in Iran or Saudi Arabia or even Pakistan, there might be some vigorous action against them of some kind from the community or the police or something. Other places, other parts of the Muslim world, maybe less so, but it's something that that Christians generally refrain from doing in public.
President Obama spoke about Islam promoting justice, tolerance, and dignity. How true is that for religious minorities who are living in Muslim nations?
Well, it's a big problem. It's a big exception. Reciprocity, some have coined that term, is not there in terms of respect for minority rights. And in those parts of the world, they're largely Christian minorities and historic communities that don't have the same rights either under national laws or under de facto or de jure dhimmi laws of dhimmization, where they're second class citizens.
You made reference to this idea of a dhimmi, being in dhimmitude within these Muslim societies. What do you mean? Can you expand briefly?
Yeah, it's a concept that's well articulated and prescribed in Islamic law of a non-Muslim who's living under the protection of Islam, under the protection of the ruler and Sharia. The Islamic law is governing all affairs in that land. So the Christian or the Jew would agree to a set of rules that prescribe his status, his or her status within that community. They're agreed to being protected, and in doing so, they're deferring. They don't participate in military affairs. They don't have positions of leadership. They can't repair their churches. They have fourth of the status of a Muslim. There's a whole number of things which signify their lesser status within that community, as decided and prescribed in law. The number of witnesses a Christian must have in court in order to establish Their case is different from the Muslim, and in every other part of law, essentially, there's a difference is codified as well.
How would you encourage Christians to pray for Muslims?
Praying for them that in their prayers, that in their soul searching and looking over their lives and examining their religion, that they would see the great need of forgiveness and see that Jesus provides that. To see that his love and his justice are one, and that he has given himself to them. And if they can see that in Christian and the acts of love that we do, they would see a loving God that has shown himself in Christ.
Okay, Marshall Sun of the Barnabas Fund. Marshall, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to show you now a slide. I do TV programs through the Trinity Channel. Those of you who go online, this isn't TBN, it's trinitychannel.com. If you go there, you can click on something, and you can get the app. You can watch it live. It's a TV channel. It's satellite. It's also internet. You can do it on your phone, ABNSAT as an app, and it'll say the Trinity Channel. We do programs sharing the gospel and exposing Islam. And this is a program that I was on some time ago. I'm not going to show you the whole segment because I get a little bit, I probably get a little over the top with this particular Muslim because he was so ugly and so insulting. But I want you to listen, if you can understand his English with his accent, as to what he says about the Islamic agenda. Okay? This little 1 minute of what he says is one of the most clear admissions that Islam wants to take over the world and will fight to do so that I've ever seen in the English language. It was on a show that I did some years ago. Let's see if we can get it to come up.
You go ahead, Sheikh Omar.
Muhammad, you know, before Islam revealed to him, he was an Arab individual. So how Islam spread? By one man. Yes, one man with the will of God. He is the final messenger. He conquered, you see, the East and the West. So now you all should be worried. You should be worried because it started by one person, now with 1.5 billion Muslims around the world. Yes, you should be worried. You must be worried because you are on the falsehood. And the Islam is the truth coming to you. You like it, you don't like it. Islam going to dominate the world. You're going to be conquered the whole world. And one day you're going to see not one 9/11, you're going to be many 9/11s around the world until you either submit to the law and order of Islam or fight and die for your own cause and go to hellfire. But we fight for the cause of God, for the sake that the command of God will be prevailed and people will be subservient to Almighty Allah. That's what Tawheed is about. If you want to fight me, I will fight you. You pay the price. Die for what you believe. No problem. And go to hellfire. It's up to you. But for me, I will die to what I believe as a Muslim.
Can I just...
He doesn't pull any punches, does he? Did you catch some of what he said? The gist of what he said is, you all should be worried. One man, Muhammad, conquered the East and the West. Now there's 1.5 billion Muslims in the world. You should be very worried. You didn't like 9/11. There's going to be many 9/11s until you submit to the will of Almighty Allah, or you fight and die and for your own cause and go to the hellfire. If you want to fight me, I'll fight you. Fight and die and go to hell for your own cause. It doesn't bother me. That's what he said. Oh, and he says, you like it, you don't like it, Islam's going to dominate the world. Nice guy. All right. I don't let you listen to what I said. If you want to know, you have to go on the internet and find out. Look at these pictures here. Butcher those who mock Islam. Behead those who insult Islam. Europe, liberalism, go to hell. Look at this little child. Behead all those who insult the Prophet. Indonesia, behead those who insult Islam. This is in Australia. This is in London. Those are real signs. Where would they come up with such stuff? They talk about conservatives having hate speech. Why don't they talk about this? Where do they get such notions? Well, you may not know this guy. Theo van Gogh was killed about 15 years ago in Holland. He made a movie that said something about Muhammad that this Muslim guy didn't like. Shot him 20 times, stuck a knife in his chest, and put a note on there to say, this is what happens to those who insult my prophet. You know this guy? This guy, remember those attacks in Paris a couple years ago? There's been several. This is that newspaper agency that they would put out cartoons of Muhammad. That's supposed to be Muhammad right there. They had been threatened many times. Basically, he said, I'd rather die standing, you know, than live on my knees in chains or whatever. And he was killed by Muslims who went, machine gunned him and his staff. Why? Because they made cartoons of Muhammad in the newspaper. Now, you might think these people are a little overboard. Obviously, this can't be what Islam really teaches. Well, one of the best ways to know what Islam really teaches is look at the Quran, look at what Muslim scholars say, and here's a Muslim scholar who will tell you what happens to people who insult Muhammad. And the question he's addressing in Arabic, so you have to read the subtitles. He says, the question is, what if somebody insults Muhammad, but then later repents and asks for forgiveness? Should we accept the forgiveness? This is what he has to say. You got to read.
وقبل الحذاء
وقال أنا عايز كل المسلمين يعدوا كل واحد يضربني بالنعل. هل من حق الحاكم أن يقبل هذا؟ ده سؤال أنا بطرحه وهجاوب عليه. الجواب أنه لا يجوز لأحد قط أن يقبل هذا. طب وما نعمل في إيه؟ نقتله. قال لك ده تاب، برضو نقتله حتى وإن تاب.
Did you get that? What do we do to people who insult Muhammad? We kill him. What if they repent? We still kill him. There's a Muslim imam and scholar not only admitting it, but proudly proclaiming it on, I think it was Egyptian TV. By the way, when the Muslim Brotherhood was in power in Egypt that one year, like I mentioned how the Obama administration helped that take place, a lot of these Muslim Brotherhood people, see, Muslim Brotherhood was outlawed in Egypt before. When Obama came and did that speech telling how wonderful Islam is, he told the Egyptian government, you better have the Muslim Brotherhood there to hear the speech. So they allowed them to come. And then, of course, he had work to put them in power. During that one year, all of these guys were real emboldened to say exactly what they believe. Now you don't get as much. So a lot of those video clips come from that time when the Muslim Brotherhood was in power in Egypt, and they weren't afraid to say that, because a lot of Muslim Brotherhood people were exiled from Egypt during the time of Sadat and the time of Mubarak, and now again in the time of Sisi. They were in power. Once they got out of power, now they're once again an outlawed party, the Muslim Brotherhood. Sharia law on insulting Muhammad, it's unanimously agreed that if a Muslim abuses or insults the Prophet, he should be killed. And then most Muslim schools of thought believe that the unbeliever should be killed as well, but there are some that say not. Now, here are some verses that are in the Quran that you're most likely to hear at Chapel Hill or Elon College or some other place. Chapter 109, verse 6. These are in the Quran. Unto you, your religion, oops, and unto me, my religion. That doesn't sound too special to me, but they kind of say, well, that means we don't care, you do what you want. And then the next verse is a little bit better, I guess. Let there be no compulsion in religion. Truth stands out clear from error. Whoever rejects evil and believes in Allah has grasped the most trustworthy handhold that never breaks. Allah. So in other words, there's no compulsion in religion. So you can be whatever you want. Doesn't matter. Well, these verses are in the Quran. Why don't Muslims follow them? Well, there is this doctrine in Islam of abrogation. Remember how we mentioned before that when Muhammad was weak and while he was alone in Mecca, he never talked about fighting. And I'm going to show you some of the other verses. He actually said, we have it in the Quran, the Christians and the Jews and the Sabians and the Muslims, if you believe in God and do good works, essentially you're all going to go to heaven. He said that. Then later he says, if you're not a Muslim, you're going to hell. Well, which is it? It's a clear contradiction. There's a doctrine in Islam that's deep-seated. It's called al-nasukh wa al-mansukh. It is the abrogator and the abrogated. In the Bible, I do not believe we have any true contradictions. Liberals and skeptics say the Bible contradicts. I don't believe that. But in the Quran, there are contradictions. The difference is Muslim scholars don't say, oh, no, we don't have contradictions. They say, yes, we do, but we've already worked that out because we've decided which ones we should go on. And the ones we should go on are the ones that came later. They came later in Muhammad's life, later in Muhammad's career. So if this one says, let there be no compulsion in religion, and this one says, kill the polytheist wherever you find him, which one do we follow? Whichever one came later in his prophetic career. Guess which one came later? Kill the polytheist wherever you find him. And that nullifies, abrogates, and makes void the previous verses. They call it the Meccan verses, because they were revealed in Mecca when he was weak, and the Medinan verses, when he was in power, in control, and led 28 military raids, pillaged, plundered, killed, and took over several groups and towns. He actually killed. Muhammad oversaw the beheading personally of 750 Jews in one day in Medina, Banu Qurayza. Confusion. Here we go. 9:5. When the forbidden months are past, then fight and slay the pagans wherever you find them. Muslims take that and say, if there's a Hindu here, we should kill him. It doesn't matter if he's fighting us or if he's nice or not. He's a polytheist. He's a pagan. That word pagan in Arabic is mushrik, and it's primarily talking about those who associate anything with Allah. Some Muslims say Christians are mushrik because we associate Jesus with God. But Hindus and polytheists, kill them wherever you find them. Don't even give them a chance to be subjugated and to pay jizya. Just kill them. That's what it says. It's very plain. It's very simple. Now, how does that line up with this? Let there be no compulsion in religion. Seems like a contradiction. Study Islamic scholarship. There was no contradiction. That was when Muhammad was weak. Now Islam, we're supposed to kill them wherever you find them. The next verse, look at this. Why were there all of these pictures? Why do Muslims got this thing about beheading people? Behead those who insult Islam. Behead those who insult Islam. Behead those who... Why do they always want to behead? Well, here it is. Remember, thy Lord inspired the angels with the message, I am with you. Give firmness to the believers. I will instill terror. Where does terrorism come from? I will instill terror into the hearts of the unbelievers. Smite ye above their necks, and smite all of their fingertips off of them. Chapter 8, verse 12 of the Quran. Where do they get the idea to behead people? Their holy book. It's a direct command. This sounds really good. This is a Meccan verse. Surah Al-Baqarah, verse 62. Indeed, those who believed and those who were Jews or Christians or Sabians, those who believed in Allah in the last day and did righteousness, they'll have their reward with their Lord. No fear will there be concerning them, nor will they grieve. That sounds great. That's nice, isn't it? Everybody's going to heaven. Well, here it is again. This is really troubling. By the way, Vaughn, is it? He asked a question. He's not here. He asked a question earlier. He said, well, when you talked about Muhammad's aorta being cut, and the Quran says this and the Hadith says it, are you proving that the Quran is true? And I said, well, that's a good question, because actually we start with the Bible, and we talk about how the Bible says that Muhammad's not a prophet, and then we go to the Quran. Also, in the Quran, something I've left out here, this is really interesting. What do you think the Quran says about the Bible? The Quran talks a lot about the Bible, the New Testament, the Old Testament. What do you think it says about it? Do you think it says it's wrong, don't believe it? It actually says it's true. It's all from God, and you should believe all of it. This was a fatal mistake for Muhammad. He should have said, oh, it's all a bunch of junk. This is the real religion. And then at least he could have been consistent. The problem is Muhammad didn't know what was in the Bible most of the time. And that is why you have verses like chapter 3, verse 84, which says this. Say, we have believed in Allah and in what was revealed to us and what was revealed to Abraham, Ishmael, Isaac, Jacob, and the descendants, and in what was given to Moses and Jesus and to the prophets from their Lord. We make no distinction between any of them. We are Muslims. Submitting to him. That sounds great. We believe in Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Moses and Jesus, and we believe in what was revealed to them. And they believe in the Old Testament, the New Testament. They say, we believe it, and we don't make any difference between that and the Quran and Muhammad. They're liars, because they do. They say, the Quran says it's all the same. But then, of course, the Quran contradicts. And, of course, it also contradicts itself. Because look at this verse, 385, the very next verse. And whoever desires other than Islam as religion, never will it be accepted from him, and he in the hereafter will be among the losers. How can it say we believe all of those books, and yet whoever, and we don't make any distinction, but whoever is not a Muslim is going to hell. That's what it says. Muhammad was confused, folks. He didn't know. Here's another one. Now look at this. Another verse, very similar. Those who believe, those who follow the Jewish scriptures and the Sabians, the Christians, they're basically going to go to heaven in chapter 5, verse 69. It says Christians are going to go to heaven. Four verses later in the Quran, look what it says. 573. They speak blasphemy who say that Allah is the third of the three. There is indeed no God except the one God. Who do you think they're talking about there? Christians and the Trinity. So you're a blasphemer if you believe in the Trinity. And look at the very two verses later. The Messiah, the son of Mary, was only a messenger. Oops, I pushed something wrong. Was only a messenger. And what does it say? He was only a messenger and he passed away. And then it says, it also says in 574, I don't know why I don't have that up there, if you say that Jesus, the Messiah, is the Son of God, you are a blasphemer and you're going to hell. So in 569, Christians are going to heaven. In 573, if you believe in the Trinity, you're going to hell. In 574, if you believe that Jesus is the Son of God, you're going to hell. Apparently, Muhammad didn't know what it was to be a true Christian. And so what Islam says is Judaism was right until Christianity came. Christianity was right until Islam came. And if you're a good Christian, there is such a thing as a good Christian in Islam. You know what it is? It's one who becomes a Muslim. If you're a Christian and haven't become a Muslim, then you're a Christian who disbelieves and you should be fought and killed. Strange, but that's the way they look at it. That was probably confusing. Any questions on that? All right. You just hadn't raised your hand. All right. What's it like to live in a Muslim country? We already talked a little bit about that. I'll leave that video. If we have extra time, we'll look at it later. This is important. The Pact of Umar. Now, have you ever heard Muslims or people say, well, you know, we talk about Islamic terrorism, and they say, yeah, but what about the Crusades? Have you ever heard that? What about you Christian, you meanies and the Crusades? You went to Israel and you tried to kill all the Muslims and get back your holy land. Who are you to say that Islam is wrong? Have you ever heard that argument? Well, you know what you should say? Now, let me ask you, those Muslims who had that land, how did they get it? How did they get that land in the first place? They got it by jihad, by physical armed warfare. A bunch of hypocrites accusing the Crusaders. And they got it in 634 AD, 2 years after Muhammad died, the Muslims took over Jerusalem. And the leader then, Umar was a little after that, but he was the leader, and they put forth a pact. And here it is. This is what happened in Jerusalem, because Jerusalem didn't have Muslims in it. It had Jews and Christians. So the Muslims come in, what are they going to do? Well, you Jews and Christians can stay, but if you do, you have to follow our rules. And here are the rules that the Jews and Christians had to keep. And this is called the Pact of Umar. It's very important because anywhere in the world of an Islamic nation, Jews and Christians have certain rights that Hindus and atheists don't have. Now, I don't know if you should call them rights or burdens, but here they are. Christians and Jews are forbidden to build churches or monasteries in their cities or nearby areas. So you can't build any new churches. They are not allowed to renovate such buildings. So if you have a hurricane, you can't fix your church. They must allow any Muslim to lodge in these buildings for 3 nights and provide him with food. They must never shelter a spy nor show any duplicity to Muslims. They are not to teach their children the Quran. They must not display any sign of their unbelief. So you can't wear a cross or anything. Or forbid their relatives from converting freely to Islam. Furthermore, they must show reverence to Muslims and give them pride of place at their assemblies. They should avoid appearing like Muslims in their clothing, their head covers, their shoes, and the parting of their hair. They must not speak the language of Muslims nor use their names. They are not allowed to use a saddle on a beast of burden. They had to ride side saddle, nor bear a sword, nor any other weapon. Their rings must not bear Arabic scriptures. They must refrain from selling wine. They must have the front of their hair cut and wear their own kind of clothing all the time and must use belts. They are not to display a cross or any of their books as they are passing Muslims on the way. Their dead must not be buried nearby a Muslim cemetery. They should not ring their bells in a loud manner. Equally, they must not raise their voices while reading the scriptures in their churches. They are forbidden to parade their palm branches on Palm Sunday. Now, should Christians ever deviate from obeying these rules, Muslims would cease to honor the covenant that had protected them. In that case, Muslims can deal with them as if they had become people of discord and trouble. You see what this does? You follow these rules. Anytime the Muslim says, hey, you're not following these rules, they can get anything they want from you. Because if not, they're going to kill you. And this is very important because this is essentially what's in effect in Muslim lands all around the world to some degree or another. The Pact of Umar. Now, Islam in America, let's talk about this a little bit. Very few Muslims in America until the mid-20th century. There were a few Muslim slaves, but Islam is not the religion of Africa, okay? And so they were very few, but there were a few. There were a few African converts who were taken slaves and brought to America, but very few. So there was very few Muslims in America till the 20th century, mid-20th century in particular. Islam grew in the 20th century through immigration and refugees and black American conversion. Now, I say black here because I'm not talking about people who came from Africa and moved to America as Islam, Muslims, because that does happen. I'm talking about African Americans who are American, who converted to Islam. Anyone know any famous ones in the 20th century? Muhammad Ali is one, yeah. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, those kind of guys. Okay. In 1950, there were only 50 mosques in all of America. A mosque is a Muslim place of worship. Today, there's well over 2,000, and that number is probably closer to 3,000 now. That number is about 10, 15 years old, 2,000. That's a tremendous growth, 50 to 2,000. Fastest growing religion in America. Now, there's Muhammad Ali. Who's the guy he's sitting with on the couch? Anybody know? Elijah Muhammad. You ever heard of Elijah Muhammad? Now, we had a discussion at lunchtime a little bit about this. Who's that guy in the bottom right corner? Louis Farrakhan. He's still in the news, isn't he? And now, who's the guy above him? Probably nobody knows that. His name it'll get to me in just a second. I forget it. But anyways, he is supposedly, this Islam, the nation of Islam, is not true Islam. It's really a cult of Islam. It's kind of like, say, the Jehovah's Witnesses to Christianity or the Mormons. This guy in the top right-hand corner started this religion in Detroit in about 1930. His last name was Fard. I think his name was Wallace Fard, F-A-R-D. Well, he came and started this religion and basically said that the true religion of black Americans and Africans is Islam. And Islam is the original religion of Africa, which of course is not true. And so he said, I'm going to give you your original name. I have secret knowledge from Allah. And so that's the phenomenon of changing the names. And what developed later, he wasn't around very long. And then this other guy, Elijah Muhammad, took over. This guy, Fard, disappears. This guy, Elijah Muhammad, took over. Now, some people think that he killed him, but we don't have any evidence for that. So he takes over this religion. He says it's Islam, but it's really not. He has very strange beliefs that are really not Islamic. For example, Allah is black. The devil is white. The more black you are, inherently the more righteous you are. The more white you are, inherently the more sinful you are. Now, you talk about racist ideology. This is as racist as you can get. And so what happened was a lot of African Americans did begin to convert to this nation of Islam in the 20th century. Muhammad Ali, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar were big names that did this. And it was you've heard of Malcolm X. It was a religion, but it claimed to be Islam, but it really wasn't. And really, it was more kind of a black empowerment movement. Malcolm X, you know, was killed, right? And most people think that this guy, he was number one, Elijah Muhammad. Number two in the whole thing was Malcolm X. Most people believe he had Malcolm X killed. Why? Malcolm X was into this 100%. Malcolm X says, well, I'm a Muslim. I should go to Mecca. Well, Elijah Muhammad never went. Malcolm X goes to Mecca, and he's there worshiping Allah. And guess what he finds out? All Muslims are not black. There's brown Muslims. There's yellow Muslims. There's white Muslims. And he begins to leave this nation of Islam and become a true Muslim. And when he does, this guy doesn't like it. And so Malcolm X got killed. This guy is who basically has the remnant of this religion. It's very small now compared to what it once was. I think it's about 10,000 people, but it was up in the millions. But interesting phenomenon, black Americans, many entered into this, but they left this. Instead of going back to Christianity, where most of them had their roots, they've moved into full-fledged Islam. So you will find today that in America, there are one of the large numbers of converts to America. Who is converting to Islam in America? There's a lot of converts. But two groups that you can look at that are converting, number one, women, which is very strange because women get beat and don't have any rights in Islam. And number two, African Americans. These are two of the main groups that we find converting. There are other people converting too, and we'll talk about why. But one of the reasons that black Americans are still converting to Islam is even though they generally don't go anymore to this, there is still some kind of idea that's been promulgated. Christianity is the white man's religion. Islam is the true religion of Africa. In fact, that's not true. If you study, and I'll show you in a minute some information, you know, we always hear about the slave trade and how the Western European nations took all these African slaves. It's true, and it was a sin. Did you know that the Muslim nations took about 10 times as many black Africans out of Africa as slaves to the Middle East? We don't hear about that. And they did it far longer, much earlier, and they did it all the way up until the 1960s. Saudi Arabia didn't outlaw slavery until like 1963. Why? Because in Islam, slavery is good. Muhammad was a slave trader. Okay, let me, any of you remember the movie Not Without My Daughter? Anyone see that? Some of you don't know and I have an idea. I'm going to show you just the trailer. This was a Hollywood movie about a true story. A woman, American woman. Remember, one of the largest groups of people that convert to Islam is women. Doesn't matter what color, white, black, doesn't matter. Women, which is crazy because women don't have any rights in Islam. But they're not told the truth. Here's one that wasn't told the truth. And this was a true story. Sally Field plays the actress, but this really did happen. I'm just going to show you the trailer for this movie, and if you want, you can go get it sometime and watch it.
Well, it's my turn. You always sit on Daddy's lap.
Don't fight over me, girls.
You know, I was born in Persia. Well, they call it Iran now.
It scares me.
All I want to do is go for 2 weeks with you and Mahtab and visit my family.
In 1984, Betty Mahmoudi's husband took her and her daughter to Iran to meet his family.
It's all changed.
He swore they would be safe.
You know, it's a different culture. I just don't understand it.
He swore they would be happy. He swore they'd be coming home soon.
Sweetheart, you haven't packed anything. You want me to do it for you?
No.
He lied.
I don't know how to say this to you. We're not going back. We're staying here. I want us to live in Iran. I know it's the right decision if you just give it a chance.
No, I won't stay here. You can't.
Are you listening? You're in my country now. You're my wife. You do as I say. You understand me?
If you marry an Iranian man.
The movie, my computer is going slow, but essentially what happens is he takes her to Iran, we're just going to go visit the family. And then after 2 weeks, no, we're going to stay here. And she wants to go home, and no. And he starts to beat her and threaten her and all of this stuff. Finally, the woman and the child escape back to America. It's a great story, and it actually happened. And the problem is it happens a lot. And unfortunately, a lot of American women, you find out, why is it that women convert to Islam? You know why? Anyone have an idea? What's the real reason most women convert to Islam? They get in love with a man who's a Muslim, and somehow or another they decide. They generally don't like to admit this. They become a Muslim in order to please this man. And there's some horror stories about this. And this is one. It was a Hollywood film, but it's actually a true story. Slavery in Islam. Muhammad was a slave trader. He had all kinds of slaves, including African slaves. And it says, look at chapter 33 of the Quran, verse 50. Prophet, we have made lawful to you the wives to whom you have granted dowries. Lawful means he can engage in sexual relations. We have been made, because Muslims can only have four wives, no more. But Muhammad had 13. As a matter of fact, if you study the hadith, some Muslims come to Muhammad and say, oh, Prophet, you said Allah said that we can only have four wives, but we see you have 13. How is that? He says, wait. Oh, Prophet, what is not allowed for the regular Muslim is allowed for you. You have no shame. Take as many wives as you want. And this becomes in the Quran. That's pretty convenient, isn't it? And that's what happened here. Prophet, we've made lawful to you the wives to whom you've granted dowries and the slave girls whom God has given you as booty. Okay? All right? There are many verses. There's other things that point to the fact that Muhammad was a slave trader. Here it talks about how Muhammad gave two black slaves. He traded for one other slave. It doesn't say whether he was an Arab or what. Muhammad was a slave trader. Now, I hope this video will not give us any trouble. This is very chilling, the first time I saw it. This is a video done, I think, by National Geographic in the very early 60s, showing slavery in Kuwait. They had slavery going on in slave trading markets in the 1960s. And this was kind of an expose. I hope the video will work. Yeah, it's not looking like. Let me try to get that real quick because I don't want you to miss that. Any questions while I'm trying to get this? Who has a question? Anyone?
I have a friend who's living in Sawara, which is now part of Indonesia, that said that when he was there in the 50s that the imams were encouraging Muslims to immigrate to non-Muslim countries, really with the purpose of changing that culture to Islam eventually.
Yes.
I have noted that the immigrants in Europe have sectors of those countries that are essentially ruled under Sharia law and that the civil authorities are really afraid to go into them.
No-go zones. That's
correct approach to the expansion of Islam.
That's correct, and they do. Welcome, John. Welcome. There's a fellow from my church in Mooresville. Welcome, brother. Yes, that's correct. That does happen. Absolutely. Yeah. Let's see if this video will play here.
Kuwait, with a population of scarcely 300,000, takes in close to $3 million a day in oil royalties. Not that these millions are allowed to trickle down, but to raise the standard of living of the people. of the Fellaheen or the Bedouins.
Let's see.
Kuwait, with a population of scarcely 300,000, takes in close to $3 million a day in oil royalties. Not that these millions are allowed to trickle down.
I'll give it one more try. If not, we'll just move on. I'm sorry. It is a very powerful video.
To raise the standard of living of the misery and desperation.
Well, it looks like I'm going to get it. Anyways, it shows a picture of slaves, black African slaves, doing slave work in Kuwait in the 1960s. And the Muslims there, they didn't have any problem with them going and videoing them and saying, yeah, of course, these are our slaves. My father said that when he was young, it was a sign of status. How many slaves do you have? You know, the people who had the most slaves were, they had the good status. Now, this is something that, unlike Christianity, you know, how many slaves did Jesus have? You know, how many slaves did Paul have? Slavery was allowed in the Old Testament of fellow Jews, but it was something they would be freed eventually. But in Islam, you get slaves by going and conquering people. And it's a good thing, and it's property. And so I'm sorry that video didn't work. All right. Any questions so far? Any further questions? Let's see where we are.
I've heard it rumored that slavery is still practiced in the Middle East.
That's correct. I believe it is on the sly. It has technically been abolished, but it seems like it is. It is, especially in places like the UAE. They have a lot of Filipinos and Pakistanis and others, people from very poor nations, and they're promised work and money, and they're kind of sold off through that. And then they get over there, and they have no rights. They don't know. They don't speak the language. They have no connections. And the people just keep them as servants, and whether they pay them or don't pay them, and then they just threaten to, you know, turn them out. And these people don't have anywhere to go. And so they essentially become slaves. And it does happen. As a matter of fact, when ISIS took control of northern Iraq, did you know that they reopened the slave market? They had a published price list, 20 to 30 years old, $130 for a Christian girl, 30 to 40 was 75, and 40 to 50 was 45, you know, something like that. Terrible. They started it all over again. And they used Muhammad, and they said, this is all correct, and this is all right. Any other questions? Yes, there is. There is, absolutely. But and of course, we see terrorist attacks in America. The people who do them usually went to a mosque. And then after it happens, we didn't know anything about him. We never preached anything like that in our mosque. But yeah, they exist. They're a minority, thank goodness. But they do exist, yes. Yep. Any other questions? Yes, ma'am. Not technically, but there are movements that they're trying to get it in, and you can look at a YouTube video. One of my colleagues, David Wood, who is a debater, he was in Michigan on my TV program up there. He was in the streets of Dearborn during this Arab American festival, and he got arrested, and basically got roughed up for trying to share Christ with Muslims on the street there. And finally, he had a legal case against them, and he won. But that was practical Sharia law was taking place. Technically, no, although they're still trying. Let me speak to you about something very, two things that because we're a little ahead since that video didn't play. There's two things you need to be aware of. The homosexual marriage business, it went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said, yes, that's right. Now, these homosexuals have no religious text to stand on. They don't have a Bible that says homosexual marriage is good and commanded and you should do it, okay? They don't, right? So the Supreme Court just says, we think it's great, do it, okay? What's coming next, I firmly believe, is polygamy. Because Muslims have a much stronger case than the homosexuals do. In Islam, in the Quran, it says you can take wives, 2, 3, or 4, as many as you would like. They have a religious injunction that they are allowed to take up to 4 wives. Now, if that same Supreme Court, I know it's changed a little bit, was to look at a case of a Muslim man who says he has 4 wives, I would think that if they had that case come to them, they'd say, well, you know, you got a point. After all, you have, this is your religion. I think that argument's coming next. There's another one that you need to be aware of. Have you ever heard of female genital mutilation? Sounds terrible, but this is something that they do in Muslim countries, and this is something that is in the Hadith, and this is something that they're doing here in America, and it's not supposed to be allowed, forced on young women, and so they're now fighting in Michigan. They are trying to get it legal that parents can do this forcibly to their teenage daughter. And their argument is that this is what Islam teaches and we should be able to do it. Be careful. These kind of arguments are being made, and there are liberal judges who could care less about the biblical foundation of our laws who are saying, you know, maybe that makes sense. There was a case in Pennsylvania where there was a parade, and I don't remember all the details, and someone was dressed up like Muhammad, making fun of Muhammad or something. A Muslim was on the side watching it. He went out and assaulted the guy and knocked him on his back on the ground. So this guy charged him with assault and battery, and the judge threw it out because the Muslim said, well, look, my religion says, you know, that we should really kill whoever insults the prophet. I didn't kill him. I just roughed him up. He said, you know, you've got a point. Case dismissed. That's Sharia law taking place in America, even though it doesn't technically exist. Yes, brother.
When I was pastoring near Cleveland, Ohio, there was a young Muslim girl who was going to Cleveland State University.
Yeah.
And she, against her parents' wishes, began to date a non-Muslim boy.
Yes.
And after they instructed her to break the relation off, she didn't. They physically punished her. Continued to date the boy, and then one evening she was shot dead on the steps there at the university. Two of her cousins were arrested. But the issue of honor killing was forbidden to be brought up in the court.
That's right. Thank you for bringing that up. That's a terrible story. That has happened a lot. There are honor killings here in America and in Canada, and basically, to preserve the honor of Islam and of the family, if the son, usually the daughter, starts dating a non-Muslim, they tell them not to, they'll kill them. They'll kill them. That's happened a lot. And it does happen. And there is some verses in, there is some hadith that push that in Sharia law. That exists. Right? Yeah, this is very political. It's very political. And unfortunately, you know, our federal court system is all political. And we know that, whichever way it goes. And what I'm sharing with you is extremely political. In other words, I don't mean for it to be political. I'm not trying to change the facts. But the reason that Chapel Hill or someone like that wouldn't want me to speak is because this is completely politically incorrect. The difference is what I'm sharing with you isn't politically correct, it's just correct. Do you want political? Isn't that interesting? Political correct is really just a euphemism for a lie. It's either correct or it's politically correct. If it's correct, it's right. If it's politically correct, it's not right, but we want you to feel good. We want you to know the truth. Let me share this, and then we'll take our break and go to our last session. And This is something very important. I think Roscoe and I were talking. Is that your name, Roscoe?
Today it is.
P. Coltrane?
Yes.
All right. I'm looking for Boss Hogg now. That's
me too.
That's you too? All right. So we have this idea. I used to go around. I have some colleagues that go to churches and talk about Islam. And they say, you know, Joseph, we don't share a lot of the stuff you share. Now, these are Christians, good guys. I said, well, what's the problem? Well, we don't want to make the Christians afraid. If they're afraid, they'll never want to talk to a Muslim, you know, and the stuff that you share with them frighten them. And I said, well, let me tell you something. First of all, Christians are already afraid. Second of all, they're ignorant. Third of all, what you need to do is turn the lights on and share the whole truth and then explain to them that they are the answer. The fear and inactivity comes from staying in the darkness and staying in ignorance and not really knowing what to think. We need to understand that the enemy is wicked, but it's a spiritual enemy. It's Islam. And the Muslim people are not really our enemies. They might be doing things that are terrible, but ultimately they are enslaved and they are deceived by a wicked satanic religion. And when Muslims come to Christ, they give up all of this violence and this lust for murder, and they become the best Christians you've ever seen. Why? Because they've literally risked their lives in leaving Islam to become Christian. And here it is. What is Islam? We'll talk about this in the next section. Islam says that Jesus is not the Christ in the sense that we believe, the Son of God. Well, the Bible says whoever says Jesus is not the Christ is what? Antichrist. Islam, at 1.5 billion strong, is the largest antichrist force on the face of the earth. The American military is not big enough to destroy Islam. Why? Because you cannot destroy a spirit with a missile. You understand? No matter how many wars we fight, and I'm not against the wars, sometimes they're needed, but no matter how many wars we fight, we will not solve this problem with physical war, because it's a spiritual war. And there's only one force on the face of this earth that is competent and equipped to deal with this foe of Islam, and I'm looking at it right now. It's the body of Christ. Greater is he that is in you than he that is in the world. The problem is Satan has done a double whammy on the church. The more liberal-leaning churches, oh, Muslims are our brothers, and we're all going to go to heaven. Kumbaya, my Lord, kumbaya. Let's, you know, have fun. Let's all go out on a camping trip or whatever. And then on the other side, we got like the guy in the beginning. He says, if you're a Muslim, you can go to hell with the rest of them, you know. Unfortunately, I know every Christian doesn't talk like that, but I would tell you about 90% of the church falls into one of those two categories, whether we admit it or not. But there is a right and a biblical way to look at this thing. And I believe God is waiting for the church to rise up and to be this answer and to be this solution. The government hadn't figured it out yet, okay? And the media certainly hasn't figured it out yet. There's certainly, we're not going to get this from public education. Who's going to do it? If it's going to be done, it can only be done through the body of Christ. And that's my challenge to you for our next session and last one. But before we do, I desperately need some caffeine. So let's take a break.